It's an honor to introduce a scientist and author whose work I have been following since my undergraduate days. I know that I'm not alone in being inspired by his books. The Selfish Gene, for instance, was a lightning bolt of clarity and forceful argument and represents an ideal of good science writing. His many books since have just gotten better.
His next book, which will be published later this year, is The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution, which comes out in September.
He possesses those virtues of being both eloquent and forthright, never hesitating to say directly what he means.
He will probably say things which you may disagree. And of course, he will offer ideas with which you can cheer.
And so, without further ado, Richard Dawkins.
Richard Dawkins.
Dr. Richard Dawkins.
For me, coming back to America after a year's absence was exhilarating. After the recent November election, the whole world seemed to let out a collective sigh of relief. It was as though a dear friend had returned to the fold of civilization. And the world of science, too, feels a new sense of hope. The ban on stem cell research has been lifted. From what I understand, there will be more funding for science. For science and other research that has no connection with homeland defense. And once again, the United States can, as you might say in these parts, step up to the plate as leaders in the world of science. But I have also been greeted with stronger reactions against science and reason. Some of my American colleagues have suggested that those theocrats, whose sole mission apparently is to destroy the secular dream of the founding fathers and replace it with the nightmare of Stone Age morals and mysticism, are behaving like cornered and wounded animals. Organizations such as the so-called Discovery Institute, ill-named, and Answers in Genesis, they long ago lost in the halls of science, they've lost again and again in the courts of law, so fear tactics and whinging about being offended is all that they have left. They have hijacked terms such as academic freedom to push their own agenda. They do everything they can to intimidate science teachers and professors in both public schools and universities. Bills have been put to numerous state legislatures in Louisiana, Texas, Missouri, Oklahoma, Florida, Iowa, Alabama, Mississippi, New Mexico, Michigan, but apparently not in Nebraska. Congratulations. The wording of these bills vary, but they all hit the same hot buttons: academic freedom, teach the controversy, diversity of opinion, views of the people. The Discovery Institute I just mentioned, a very well-financed lobby for creationism, has published no research papers in defense of their position. They shamelessly bypass the peer review process and appeal directly to a public which is unqualified to assess the matter. Unqualified precisely because the very same activists deny them a proper education in science and the scientific method. Teach the controversy? What controversy? Academic freedom? Well, listen to what just happened in Oklahoma. This is a portion of House Resolution 1014 to be introduced into the Oklahoma state legislature. I think it may be introduced this very day. Be it resolved, whereas the University of Oklahoma, as part of the Darwin 2009 project, has invited as a public speaker on campus Richard Dawkins, whose published opinion, as represented in his 2006 book, The God Delusion, and in public statements on the theory of evolution, demonstrate an intolerance for cultural diversity and diversity of thinking. Diversity of thinking. Presumably, that would include... I hope you can read what it says on the blackboard of this intelligent falling theory of gravity lecture. dx over dt equals 1 Corinthians 1 to 10. Or diversity of thinking. What about the stork theory of human reproduction?
I was viewed as an intellectual terrorist.
If you have questioned sex theory, that's it. Your career is over.
I have been told to shut up.
As a sex maniac, I'm pretty hostile to the rival stork theory.
Just stand up and question sex theory. You'll find out how risky that is. There are people out there who want to keep science in a little box where it can't possibly touch storks. Stork theory. I mean, it's just fantasy, basically. Scientists are not allowed to even think thoughts that involve storks delivering babies.
We cannot accept to treat the stork theory as an alternative scientific theory.
I'm frightened by this, but I'm not going to let it stop me from investigating, from speaking about it.
I'd like to put what I call the ultimate stork theory. It's all very well to say that the stork delivers the baby, but who delivers the stork? Some of you may have seen the original film called Expelled, in which that parody is based. Should we invite astrologers to speak to the students studying astronomy, alchemists to speak to chemistry students, flat earthers to speak to geography students in the interests of teaching the controversy? Contrary and offensive to the views and opinions of most citizens of Oklahoma. What's really offensive is the bizarre idea that a state university should only ever hear opinions that its citizens agree with. If that principle is ever accepted, you can kiss goodbye to everything that a university stands for. What on earth is a university for if it only reinforces opinions that students and the public already hold? And as it happens, evolution is a scientific fact, as securely established as anything known in science. What is the purpose of purpose? My Oxford colleague Peter Atkins, author of a textbook of physical chemistry which is sold by the cubic yard in university campus bookstores, was once invited to give a lecture in Windsor Castle, which, as you know, is one of the official residences of the Queen. Prince Philip was in the audience. At the end, he asked that question which has become so familiar to me as a cliché. He said, "Science can answer the how questions, but what about the why question?" Dr. Atkins was brief in his reply. "Sir, the why question is just a silly question." We are obsessed with the why question as a species. We humans, obsessed with purpose. It seems perfectly natural when presented with an object to ask various questions about it. What color is it? How much does it weigh? How did it come to be the way it is? How does it work? But not all questions are suitable for all objects. What is the color of jealousy? might mean something to a poet, but not to a scientist. How does it work might seem suitable for a machine, but not for a lump of clay. But the question of purpose, which doesn't necessarily have to have an answer, is one that leaps to the front of the human mind, whether it's appropriate or not. It does work for some things. It works for any machine, anything designed by a human with an aim in mind. It's a sensible question for a tin opener, a mill wheel, a rain gauge, a telescope, a toboggan, a shoe, a bicycle. For some artifacts like a digital computer, it is a sensible question, but it has a very large number of answers because it's a very versatile machine. Other objects like a sextant has only one answer. Anyway, where human artifacts are concerned, no one has any trouble understanding the why question, what is it for? It's for whatever the designer or the manufacturer intended. For objects that are neither manufactured nor living, the question of purpose is simply inappropriate, if not downright silly. What is Ayers' rock for is as inappropriate as what is the colour of jealousy. What's the purpose of the Matterhorn, sand dunes, mud, the universe, the Grand Canyon? These are not questions that should be put. It hasn't always been the case that people have refrained from questions of this sort. In medieval times, I suspect that you'd have found people struggling after serious answers to all those questions. And the answers would mostly have been concerned with benefits to people. The stars are there to beautify the night sky. Streams are to provide water to quench the thirst of travellers. This obsession with purpose was especially true for living things. Animals and plants were placed here for our use. Henry Moore, in 1653, believed that cattle and sheep had only been given life in the first place so as to keep their meat fresh till we shall have need to eat them. And those animals that we can't eat were placed there, in some cases, for the purpose of elevating our morals. As late as the 19th century, the Reverend William Kirby thought that the louse was an indispensable incentive to cleanliness. Savage beasts, according to the Elizabethan bishop James Pilkington, fostered human courage and provided useful training for war. Horseflies, for one 18th century writer, were created so that men should exercise their wits and industry to guard themselves against them. Lobsters were furnished with hard shells so that before eating them, we could benefit from the improving exercise of cracking their claws. Another pious medieval writer thought that weeds were there to benefit us. It is good for our spirit to have to work hard pulling them up. And it's not difficult to imagine this mindset finding a purpose in mountains and mud and deserts and stars. As I said in my opening, the human mind is obsessed with purpose. And this kind of thing persists to this day.
If you study a well-made banana, you'll find on the far side there are three ridges. On the close side, two ridges. If you get your hand ready to grip a banana, you'll find on the far side there are three grooves, on the close side, two grooves. The banana and the hand are perfectly made one for the other. You'll find the maker of the banana, Almighty God, has made it with a non-slip surface. It has outward indicators of inward contents. Green, too early. Yellow, just right. Black, too late. Now, if you go to the top of the banana, you'll find, as with the soda can makers, they placed a tab at the top, so God has placed a tab at the top. When you pull the tab, the contents don't squirt in your face. You'll find the wrapper, which is biodegradable, has perforations. Notice how gracefully it sits over the human hand. Notice it has a point at the top for ease of entry. It's just the right shape for the human mouth. It's chewy, easy to digest. It's even curved toward the face to make the whole process so much easier. Seriously, Kurt, the whole of creation testifies to the genius of God's creative.
You probably think that's some kind of spoof. It's not. This pair, Ray Comfort and Kirk Cameron, are deadly serious. I hardly need to point out it's rather an unfortunate example because the modern banana is heavily modified by domestic breeding. This is what a wild banana looks like. You might be interested to hear that a couple of weeks ago, Ray Comfort issued a public challenge to me, offering me $10,000 to have a debate with him. I declined on the grounds that I was too busy debating the flat earth theory and of course, the stork theory of reproduction. But I added that I would debate Mr. Comfort if he would make a charitable donation of $100,000 to the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science, which exists precisely to fight wingnuts like him. Some creatures pretty much are for the benefit of humans because we have bred them so, as indeed the banana. The udder of a modern dairy cow is grotesquely enlarged compared to its wild ancestor. Its purpose has become a human purpose. A dairy cow's udder makes no sense from the point of view of natural selection. It certainly doesn't enhance individual survival, far from it. A modern dairy cow would be far more vulnerable to predators than a wild one, largely because it would be so difficult to run with the udder between its hind legs. Domestication is very much a special case, and it will serve me, as it served Darwin, as a kind of transition to natural selection. Darwin made great use of domestication in his books. The first chapter of The Origin of Species is devoted to the power of selection, in this case artificial selection, domestic selection, to change the form of animals. If artificial selection can achieve such dramatic results in just centuries, think what natural selection might do in millions of years. I'm going to use artificial selection as a kind of softening up process to explain natural selection. If you wanted to do an experimental test of natural selection, what would you do? Well, the essence of experiment is that you, the experimenter, artificially intervene. You act as the selecting agent. This is an experiment carried out over some 70 years of artificial selection of maize, corn, for high oil content versus low oil content in the two lines on the graph that you see. And you can see that in a mere 70 years, there's a more or less linear increase in oil content in the high selected line and a shallower decrease. There's not very far to go towards zero oil. Humans are molding corn cobs to our own purposes. Nature does something very similar. And doesn't that begin to suggest a special meaning of the word purpose? There's a wild rose. It's a pretty little flower, but nothing to write home about in the terms that we might lavish on a domestic rose like Peace or Lovely Lady or Ophelia. And wild roses have a delicate smell, unmistakable, but not to swoon for, like Memorial Day or Elizabeth Harkness or Fragrant Cloud. The human eye and the human nose went to work on wild roses, enlarging them, shaping them, doubling up the petals, tinting them, refining the bloom, boosting natural fragrances, adjusting habits of growth, eventually entering them in sophisticated hybridization programs. Until today, after decades of skillful breeding, we have hundreds of prize varieties, each with its own evocative name. The flower of the rose, even before human eyes and noses took up their work of genetic chiseling, owed its very existence to millions of years of very similar chiseling, very similar sculpting by insect eyes and noses. Well, actually, insect antennae, because that's what insects smell with. And the same is true of all the flowers that beautify our gardens. We already find wildflowers attractive because insects, and in some cases hummingbirds or other animals, have been there before us. Generations of selective breeders were there before us long before human gardeners came on the scene. Why do the flowers do it? Well, I'm sure you all know the answer. It's of the essence of sexual reproduction that you shouldn't fertilize yourself. If you did that, there'd be no point in having sex at all. So the flowers have somehow got to engineer that the pollen doesn't land on their own stigma. And there are various ways of doing this. Wind pollination is an obvious way, and some plants indeed do it. Pollen is a fine, light powder, and if you pump enough of it out into the air, then in the breeze, some of it will probably, a tiny fraction, will probably land on the right target, which is a stigma of a flower of your own species. But wind pollination is wasteful. A huge surplus of pollen needs to be manufactured, as hay fever sufferers know only too well. As you know, there's a much more ingenious solution. Bribe an insect or a hummingbird, which has got wings, to carry it for you directly to the right target. Bribe them with nectar. Nectar is costly to make, and it's highly prized by insects. They use it as sort of aviation fuel. And the way it works, of course, is that the insect is far more likely to carry the pollen to another flower, and the other flower may indeed be one of the same species. The ultimate, the ideal magic bullet is an insect that only visits one kind of flower, or only can visit one kind of flower. This is an orchid in Madagascar, and you can see that it has an enormously long nectary dangling down below the flower. The nectary contains the nectar. Both Darwin and Wallace, his co-discoverer of natural selection, knew about this Madagascan flower, and both these great naturalists independently predicted that there must exist in Madagascar an insect that has a tongue at least 11 inches long. Otherwise, the flower wouldn't have the nectary like that. It's a nice example of the fact that evolution can be a predictive science, contrary to what some people say. After Darwin's death, but Wallace was still alive because he lived a very long time, the moth was indeed discovered. And its name, as you see, is Xanthopan morganae predictar. If only Darwin had lived to see his prediction fulfilled. I've been softening you up for natural selection. Humans use their eyes to breed roses, dogs. Bees and hummingbirds use their eyes to breed flowers. Peahens use their eyes to breed peacocks. In every case, the result is that some genes disproportionately find themselves in the next generation. But this non-random survival of genes doesn't have to be brokered by an eye choosing. It was Darwin's great insight to see that non-random death, non-random survival, non-random success in doing all the things that living creatures do is another way in which evolution can be guided towards improvement. In modern terms, we would say that a body is a survival machine programmed to preserve and propagate the genes that ride inside it. The rationale is very simple. The genes that exist in the present are copies of genes that succeeded in the past in surviving and making copies of themselves. The vehicles of that success were ancestral bodies. Modern bodies have therefore inherited the very characteristics that made ancestral bodies successful in passing on their genes. That's why bodies work for their own survival and the survival of their offspring and other close kin, for the simple reason that the offspring and kin themselves have a good chance of containing the same genes. So we can call an organism a machine that's there to preserve and propagate the genes that built it. Notice there's not the slightest implication of deliberate, premeditated purpose. Nobody's saying the genes want to survive. It's just that the world automatically becomes full of those genes that, as a matter of fact, do survive. They're the ones that we see in the animals that we look at. And every species preserves its genes in a different way. Birds are good at flying, dolphins are good at swimming, moles and aardvarks at digging, squirrels at climbing, gibbons at swinging through the treetops, and humans, perhaps, at thinking. We too are animals, we too are survival machines for our genes. We do have extremely big brains for our size, and presumably that must mean that we used our big brains for survival, possibly for wooing mates. There's a very interesting theory that we evolved big brains to outsmart each other in social competition, and maybe specifically we might have evolved big brains as a kind of mental peacock's tail. Braininess is attractive. So the purpose of a wild animal is to preserve and propagate the genes that ride inside it. And wild animals don't waste time when they could be working at gene survival. They don't indulge in self-centered hedonistic pleasures, except insofar as those pleasures contribute directly to gene survival. They work hard to survive, they work hard to feed and protect their children, often at great cost to themselves. But now, let's look at ourselves. On the face of it, we seem to be very different. We do waste our time. We do indulge in hedonistic pleasures and recreations, which may even be risky, and have no obvious connection with individual or gene survival. We appear to be a serious exception to the Darwinian law. It just doesn't seem to be true that we spend our time working energetically for our genes. We are, of course, concerned with survival, concerned with our children, but we don't always work hard to get children, as naive Darwinism should predict. And naive Darwinism has no explanation for the widespread practice of contraception. Or worse, from the literal-minded Darwinian point of view, many people adopt the children of others. In nature, any genetically inherited urge to adopt and rear unrelated offspring would rapidly disappear from the population, ruthlessly weeded out by Darwinian selection. In nature, the only way to persuade another animal to look after your child is to deceive it elaborately into thinking it's their own. And that's, of course, how cuckoos make their genetic living. Yet in some human civilizations, the desire to adopt is so strong that the mother of an unwanted baby can sell it for money. I don't for a moment wish to knock adoption, by the way. I'm delighted that people do adopt. I'm sure there are many people here who have been adopted or who have adopted. I think it's a wonderful, unique feature of the human species. But it's not very Darwinian. There is an ambiguity in the way we use the language of purpose. When we say something like, the purpose of an aeroplane's tail is to stabilize it, we're saying something about the intention of the designer. But a bird's tail does much the same thing. If a bird didn't have a tail, it would pitch and roll like an aeroplane without a tail. So it's natural to use the same kind of language. The purpose of a bird's tail is to stabilize it. The purpose of a hedgehog's spines is to protect it. The purpose of a rabbit's fur is to keep it warm, and so on. But of course, everything about animals and plants that looks as if it's been designed for a purpose has in fact been shaped by the slow sculpting of natural selection. And I'm calling this kind of pseudo-purposiveness archaeopurpose. It's the ancient kind of purpose before the human kind of purpose or the nervous system kind of purpose evolved. It resembles deliberate intentional purpose, but it is not. There is no intention there. The archaeopurpose of a bird's wing is to aid flight, and you see there four beautiful flying machines which in their different ways would excite the admiration of any aerodynamic engineer who might have designed these things. These are man-made flying machines with a neo-purpose. The neo-purpose of a wing in a plane is to aid flight. Neo-purpose, as opposed to archaeopurpose, is the kind of purpose we are all familiar with from our own designs and schemes and goals. And my thesis tonight is that neo-purpose is itself an evolved adaptation with a survival value or archaeopurpose, in the same sense as a feather, an eye, a tail, or a backbone has an archaeopurpose. Brains have evolved with various capacities that assist the survival of the genes that made them. Among these evolved capacities is the ability to set up goals or purposes, and the ability to design machines and other artifacts that resemble naturally evolved organs like tails, wings, eyes, and hearts. And, of course, artifacts that resemble brains themselves, computers. The brain is a kind of onboard computer used to control the body's behavior in ways that are beneficial to the genes that built it. It perceives the outside world, it remembers things, it learns the consequences of its actions, good and bad. It sets up simulated models in imagination. And, here's the point of my argument today, it sets up purposes or goals in the sense of neo-purpose. The capacity to have a mental goal or neo-purpose is an adaptation with a survival value or archaeopurpose. Do man-made electronic machines have a kind of neo-purpose over and above the purpose of the designer who made them? Yes, they do. Guided missiles track a moving target like a plane. The missile is controlled by its own onboard computer, which detects the position of the target by some kind of sense organ, maybe a heat sensor, maybe it uses radar. The discrepancy between the present position of the target and the missile is measured, and the motors and steering surfaces of the missile are controlled and manipulated to reduce the discrepancy between the target and the missile. Intercept. And if the target plane takes evasive action, twisting and turning, then a good missile automatically takes countermeasures. It shows flexible, versatile behavior to close the gap between itself and the target. The missile behaves, as if its computer contains a mental picture of its goal, a neo-purpose. Cannonballs didn't have that property. They were simply lobbed in the general direction of the target. Once on their way, they didn't change direction. They just went ballistically. The cannons, of course, were designed by humans with a purpose in mind, but the cannonball itself is just a lump of iron. It doesn't have the neo-purpose property that a guided missile does, and that a bat does. So a bat is a guided missile. It tracks targets, such as insects, using, in this case, sonar, sound echoes. It can home in on a moving target, a target that is taking evasive action in just the same sort of way as a guided missile. And so I would want to say that a bat has a neo-purpose, in the same sense at least as a guided missile does, but that the bat's neo-purpose also has an archaeopurpose, which was previously, quote, designed by natural selection of ancestral bats, working on ancestral bat genes. Even very simple living things behave in some ways as though they have neo-purposes. Maggots move away from light. They're photophobic. And the way they do it is by swinging the head from side to side, rhythmically, and comparing the light intensity on the left side with the right side. And if you have a light in the room, you switch on the light in the room every time the maggot happens to be swinging to the left, and switch off the light every time it happens to be swinging to the right, then you can fool it into moving away from where it thinks the light is, which is the left in this case. I use the word think somewhat ill-advisedly. Animals employ a range of increasingly sophisticated guidance systems, paralleling the techniques developed by human engineers. Dragonflies hunt rather like bats, hunt flying insects, swooping and diving on them with all the flexibility of a man-made guided missile. They use their large eyes, their large compound eyes, to detect the position of the moving target and compute in the brain the necessary adjustments to the wings in order to home in on the target. And it's a sensible way to interpret their behavior, to say that their brain is set up as if it had a goal or neo-purpose. We're not saying they're conscious of it. They might be, but we don't know that. But they behave like a guided missile, as if they're programmed with a purpose, probably in much the same way as a guided missile. One of the most advanced things that any computer can do, and that includes the onboard computer in the skull, is simulation of the future. Computer programs playing chess have reached grandmaster standard, and this is largely done by simulating alternative futures. Whales, as you probably know, use sonar, just like bats and just like submarines. I don't know, as I said, whether dragonflies are conscious. I suspect that bats may be. I'm almost sure that whales are. But that's not the question I'm raising tonight. They, all of them, are using some kind of goal-seeking machinery, some kind of neo-purpose, which has been put there by natural selection with an archaeo-purpose. One of the main virtues of advanced goal-seeking machines with a neo-purpose is flexibility. These machines are easy to reprogram to seek a different goal. A captured enemy missile may be reprogrammed to seek out and destroy its original creators. The very property that makes the missile so effective in achieving its goal, its very flexibility and versatility, that very property makes the machinery easy to subvert to a new purpose. Which brings me back to the problem I raised earlier. Why is it that humans appear to seek goals that have nothing to do with the survival and propagation of their own genes? Why do we set up goals like making money, composing a cantata, winning a war or an election, a game of chess or tennis? Why aren't all our goals related to the one central goal of propagating our genes? And the answer is that it's our capacity to set up goals and to reprogram our goal-seeking machinery rapidly and flexibly that's been built into us by natural selection. This goal-seeking capacity and its inherent properties of flexibility and reprogrammability is an immensely useful piece of brain technology, useful in propagating genes. That's why it evolved in the first place. But by its very nature, it carries the seeds of its own subversion. Precisely because of its flexible reprogrammability, it's highly prone to seek new goals. There's a paradox in this virtue of flexible reprogrammability. If a machine is too ready to change its goals, it will never achieve any of them. What's required is some mixture of flexibility in setting up new goals, coupled with tenacity and inflexibility in pursuing them. Our brains are flexible enough to be reprogrammed away from goals that are directly concerned with gene survival and individual survival, and towards a new and arbitrary purpose, which might be inspired by religion, by patriotism, by sense of duty, by loyalty to the party, loyalty to the country. But they are inflexible enough, once reprogrammed, to spend an entire lifetime seeking the new goal. And yet another paradox, they can show great versatility and flexibility in the setting up of new sub-goals in the service of an inflexibly pursued superior goal, which may yet not be the Darwinian goal of survival. It may yet be the welfare of the party, of the faith, of the country, or whatever it is. There's a hierarchy of goals within goals. This subtle interplay between flexibility and inflexibility is something we need to work hard to understand because it has vitally important consequences. Does this posture of a hunting wolf remind you of anything? The sheepdog has been bred to herd sheep or other animals, making use of a hunting behavior pattern derived from the wolf ancestor. The hunting behavior of the ancestral wolf has been subverted by human breeding to a new purpose. There's a hunting wolf, and you can see exactly the same movement as a herding sheepdog. Subversion of goals. The patron saint of goal subversion is the Alec Guinness character in the film Bridge on the River Kwai. Colonel Nicholson was a prisoner of war of the Japanese. He was a loyal British soldier. He showed great bravery in the face of Japanese torture, but he was also an army officer and an engineer. And once he had finally been persuaded to undertake the building of a bridge, for reasons that I won't go into, a bridge that was for the Japanese war effort, he became doggedly determined to finish the bridge and to make it the best bridge ever built. He proudly imagines that the bridge, now almost completely a British endeavor, will last 600 years. He declares, "We can teach these barbarians a lesson in Western methods and efficiency that will put them to shame. We'll show them what the British soldier is capable of doing." And amazingly, he doesn't seem to realize that he's helping the barbarians achieve a key war objective. He has set up a new goal in total contradiction to the official goal of defeating the Japanese. And once he'd set up that goal, he pursued it tenaciously with intelligence, versatility, engineering skill, all the qualities that he should have been using against the enemy. The story of the bridge on the River Kwai is, of course, fiction, but the fact that audiences can empathize with Colonel Nicholson suggests that it conveys an important psychological truth. We can imagine behaving as he does. We can imagine setting up a sub-goal which completely subverts the main goal that we ought to be pursuing, insane as that is. What are some of the biological goals, the natural biological goals, the archaeopurposes that are susceptible to subversion by neo-purposes? Well, I've listed a few here, there are some more. Hunger. Our evolved desire for sweet, ripe fruit and fat has been hijacked to seek out super sweet and fatty foods. We didn't evolve with vending machines and McDonald's, so we have no evolved protection against overeating. We eat when food is available, because that would have been a good idea in our wild state, and now in the Western world, it is always available. A biologically sensible lust for sweet things is easily subverted, and we eat too much of it, it rots our teeth and makes us fat. Subversion of sex. Well, it's easy to laugh at the moose trying to copulate with the statue of the bison. But we forget how easily human males can become aroused by a crude computer-generated image. And at least the statue of the bison is in 3D. Sexual sexual desires can be subverted to gain power. For frustrated young men, access to women is a primary goal, an all-consuming purpose. How easy it is for those in power to subvert it. And when you think about it, contraception itself is a subversion of sex. From the selfish genes point of view, it has absolutely no virtue at all as far as passing on your genes are concerned. Not that I've anything against contraception. As Steven Pinker rightly said of his desire not to have children, my selfish genes can go jump in the lake. Subversion of parental care. Long ago, Conrad Lawrence pointed out that our parental instincts are stimulated by certain young animals that have some stimuli that in common with human babies. Filial obedience, which possibly has some kind of biological merit, and that again can be very easily subverted. The idea of God, the Father, the authority figure in human culture, the father figure. Other aspects of kinship. Kinship is a very important principle in Darwinism. Natural selection favors those genes that cause animals to behave in an altruistic way, a cooperative way, towards other animals that are likely to contain the same genes, which means normally kin, brothers, sisters, cousins, nephews, nieces. This also can be subverted. The kind of in-group loyalty which you see in these two groups of men, the ones on the left probably really are genetic kin. They will be members of the same tribe, probably mostly cousins, brothers, nephews, etc. The ones on the right are not particularly likely to be kin. They are exploiting fictive kin. They behave as if they are kin. They treat each other as if they are blood brothers. And it's a well-known tactic in military circles to try to arouse this feeling of brotherhood among fighting units. In-group loyalty and out-group hostility can be seen as a kind of fictive kin recognition, assisted or enhanced by uniform habits of dress, language, and so on. I always think that's about to turn into a Monty Python sketch. Not quite so much so, actually, as the banana man you saw earlier. That splendid scene of those two men looking completely dopey, sitting on chairs in the wide open space with a sort of landscape with a lake behind them. And you really expect John Cleese to appear and say, "And now for something completely different." Religion consistently uses kinship terms such as father, mother, brother, sister, my child, my brother in Christ, my brethren, exploiting kinship mechanisms that have evolved over time. Military organizations use the same trick, and so do youth gangs. In-group loyalty, fictive kinship, can be enhanced by subversion of sexual goals. And fictive kinship is readily subverted into patriotic loyalty in time of war. An entire nation can be seen as fictive kin, and a rival nation as subject to xenophobic hatred.
Oh, we don't want to lose you, but we think you ought to go for your king.
That's an actual recruiting song in Britain from the First World War. It's all too easy for rival groups of humans, fictive kin groups perhaps, to adopt incompatible goals, patriotic or sectarian claims over disputed territory. And these can be especially dangerous when implacable faith is involved. Imagine if Mohammed Atta and his 18 accomplices of September the 11th, 2001, had had nuclear weapons or modern biological weapons. Remember that for peculiarly religious reasons, these men actively wanted to die. People like that see violence and murder as their righteous obligation. In a strange way, they're good people. They did horrific things, but they genuinely and sincerely believed they were doing the right thing. They believed they were doing what their God wanted. They believed they were going straight to a martyr's heaven. It's not all bad news. There's a good side to the subversion of purpose. Our shaking off of thraldom to the selfish genes can be seen as an exhilarating liberation, as exhilarating as Wordsworth found the French Revolution. Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive. But to be young was very heaven. I suspect that our species is still young in its newfound liberation. Although the human brain's been capable of great flexibility for a long time, the takeover by the onboard computers probably ran away with itself in a big way when the rise of language enabled large groups of people to set up shared goals, which could be pursued over more than one lifetime. One inventor may set himself the task of improving methods of transport and produce the wheel. Generations of inventors, each building on the accumulated achievements of their predecessors, are capable of producing the supersonic airliner and the space shuttle. Cultural evolution is a new kind of evolution, superficially similar to the old genetic evolution, capable of producing advances in technology which mirror the old genetic advances, but at a rate which may be a million times faster. The speed of this new kind of evolution, coupled with the ease with which the human brain can be reprogrammed to adopt a new major goal, and the single-minded tenacity with which it can pursue that goal once adopted, are frightening, for they could presage great danger. There is, of course, a downside. Like advanced guided missiles, we pursue our goals with relentless tenacity and great flexibility in setting up efficient sub-goals, the sub-goals of war. The extreme rapidity of cultural evolution, driven by the cumulative pursuit of shared technical goals, makes possible the deployment of devastating technical weapons. We must hope that our species' blissful dawn will not turn as sour as the French Revolution did for Wordsworth. There are some grounds for hope. That same flexibility, versatility, and foresight which threatens us by throwing our stately Darwinian evolution into runaway overdrive could also be our salvation. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.